I'm very pleased and very honoured today, Professor Wendy Doniger. Professor Doniger is the Mircea Eliade Distinguished Service Professor of the History of Religions at the Divinity School in the University of Chicago. I'm sure you know her by her many publications. Her research interests revolve around Hinduism and mythology, and she's a long list of publications, including, among my favourites, Women, Androgyn and Other Mythical Beasts of some time ago now, Dreams, Illusions and Other Realities. I've still got my copious notes as an undergraduate on those on that text. And Other People's Myths, The Cave of Echoes, The Implied Spider, most recently Hindus and Alternative History, and many others. She has translations of Hindu classical texts, The Laws of Manu, The Rig Veda, and that early anthology, The Hindu Myths, Penguin Classics, which was a wonderful publication, I think. And, the list goes on. And there's I love that edited volume that she did some time ago of Karma and Rebirth in Classical Indian Traditions, a groundbreaking work, I think. And also the Origins of Evil in Hindu Mythology, one of the only works on problems of theodicy within Hinduism.
My Oxford DPhil.
Was Wendy's Oxford DPhil. And she was in Oxford for some years, and now since then she's been in Chicago. So we're a multi-talented scholar who has many varied interests, including horses and a novel. She's written a novel, I think, which if you ever publish it, I'm looking forward to reading. So we're very honoured, and I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Doniger. I've been a fan of her work since an undergraduate, and I feel very honoured to introduce her this afternoon. So today she'll be speaking on the politics of sexuality in ancient India. But before we go on to that, I should announce that her next two lectures on Thursday the 14th of November will be at 4 o'clock, not 5, and in the exam school. That's the Magic Ring of Memory and Forgetfulness in South Asian Literature and Folklore, and also How Widespread Was Skepticism in Ancient India. So they'll be on...
both of them at 4?
Both of them at 4, yeah, in the exam school. So today she's going to speak on the politics of sexuality in ancient India, the indebtedness of the Kama Sutra to the Arthashastra.
Thank you very much, Gavin. It's wonderful to be back. I lived 10 of the very happiest years of my life here in Oxford. Did my DPhil, had my first job, had my baby. It's good to see some old friends, Richard Gombert and Sanjukta in particular. It's just nice to be back, and it was very nice of Gavin to have invited me. And I'm glad to have a chance to try out on you today and a week from today two pieces of a book I'm working on. So I'm looking forward to the question and answer period, because I'll be taking notes and I'm still thinking this through. So I'd like to share what I have with you and see whether we can move it along a bit more. The talk today I've thought through fairly neatly. The one next week is really just some ideas that are really coming together now. And then on Thursday, the talk is from another project about jewelry, women's jewelry, and the mythology of jewelry all over the world. And I'm going to give you the India part on Thursday. So today and Tuesday, the book on really science and religion in India. And Thursday, the book about jewelry. Ancient Indian texts, ancient Hindu texts, often speak of three human goals, the Purusharthas, also called the Triple Path or the Trivarga, which every human being was supposed to achieve in order to have a full life. Dharma, Artha, and Kama, or roughly for Dharma, religion, law, justice. For Artha, politics, success, and money. And for Kama, pleasure, desire. The Manavadharma Shastra, or Laws of Manu, is supreme among Sanskrit texts about Dharma. The Arthashastra, similarly outstanding for Artha, and the Kama Sutra for Kama. I'm not going to be talking about Manu today, but you'll see he's the fall guy for the others. The Arthashastra, or textbook of politics, profit, success, is generally attributed to Kautilya, a name that means crookedness, the minister of the Mauryan emperor Chandragupta in the 4th century BCE, but it was completed in the earliest centuries of the Common Era, perhaps by 200 CE. The Arthashastra is a compendium of advice for a king. In addition to much technical information on the running of a kingdom, it contains a good deal of thought on the subject of human psychology. The Kama Sutra, or Treatise of Pleasure, is the oldest extant Hindu textbook of erotic love and one of the oldest in the world. It was probably composed sometime in the second half of the 3rd century of the Common Era in North India. Virtually nothing is known about its author, Vatsyayana Malanaga, other than his name and what we learn from the text. So that's the background for those of you who don't know the Shastras. I won't bore you anymore, I hope. The Arthashastra is therefore at least a century older than the Kama Sutra and gives no evidence of knowing any Kama Sutra, nor does it mention Kama as an organizing system. The Kama Sutra, on the other hand, explicitly mentions the Arthashastra, though it attributes it to the mythical Brihaspati, the counselor to the king of the gods, rather than to the quasi-historical Kautilya. And it regards it as primarily a text about merchants making money and superintendents of commerce and agriculture rather than government. Though the Arthashastra is deeply suspicious of kama, pleasure, in any shape or form, the Kama Sutra has respect for artha, money, as a goal, especially as far as courtesans are concerned. My argument is that the Kama Sutra is closely based upon the Arthashastra and that this connection strongly influences the worldview of the Kama Sutra. Other scholars have noted the influence of the form of the Arthashastra on the Kama Sutra, but haven't realized how extensively and closely the content of the Kama Sutra is constrained by that of the Arthashastra. I will explore first the evidence for this deeper influence, and then the ways in which the Kama Sutra pulls away from the Arthashastra. I'll conclude with a brief speculation about the implications for the later history of erotic literature in India when the Kama Sutra applies to sex the principles of politics, more precisely, the Machiavellian politics of the Arthashastra. Let me begin by pointing out the elements that the two texts have in common. Both the Arthashastra and the Kama Sutra pretend to care about Dharma and pay lip service to it at the start and finish of the book, like bookends. But on almost every page of the text, they violate Dharma. The Arthashastra by advocating violence and deception, the Kama Sutra by violating the rules of sex and marriage. Moreover, both of them, in contrast with almost all other Sanskrit textbooks, the Shastras of the period, largely ignore caste and class, which are at the heart of the social law advocated in Dharma texts, though we can read the same traditional assumptions about caste and class underlying them both. Both texts go to great lengths to justify their importance vis-a-vis the Dharma texts, but in different ways. The Arthashastra devotes an entire but rather short chapter to Dharma. When Kautilya first mentions the three goals, he lists them in the usual order, Dharma first and Kama last, and he seems to rank them in that order when he returns to the subject and expands upon it. After citing the usual politically correct statements about the goals, which he will soon identify as the viewpoints of other wrong-headed people, the Purvapaksha, the other guys in the argument, Kautilya stands up for what he really cares about, artha. So he begins, "The king should pursue kama without transgressing artha or dharma. He should not deprive himself of enjoyments. Or he should pursue the triple set equally, each intimately connected to the others. For among dharma, artha, and kama, when one is pursued excessively, it harms itself as well as the other two." So that's the party line. But then he says, Kautilya says, that's his view, "Artha alone is paramount, for artha is the foundation of dharma and kama." And this is not what Manu says. Kautilya returns to the subject at the very end of the book. He says, "This treatise brings into being and protects dharma, artha, and kama, and suppresses lack of dharma, adharma, lack of artha, anartha, and hatred, vidvesha," which is not what you expect. This use of hatred as the opposite of kama in place of what we might expect, lack of kama, meaning lack of desire or lack of pleasure, is picked up by the Kama Sutra, The Kama Sutra says, the three gains are artha, dharma, and kama, and the three losses are loss of artha, loss of dharma, and hatred, vidvesha. This is a strange divergence from the expected pattern, and the convergence of the two texts strongly suggests that the Kama Sutra has gotten it from the Artha Shastra. The Kama Sutra also echoes the Artha Shastra's lip service to the ranking of the three ghouls. It says a man's lifespan is to be divided into a full 100 years. By dividing his time, he cultivates the three goals in such a way that they enhance rather than interfere with each other, almost word for word, what the Artha Shastra says. But he says, because the lifespan is uncertain, a man pursues these aims as the opportunity arises. But he should remain celibate until he's acquired knowledge. When these three compete, each is more, dharma, artha, and kama compete, each is more important than the one that follows. Dharma comes first, artha comes first, kama comes second. But, and here we have the real view, but artha in the form of wealth is the most important goal for a king because it is the basis of dharma and for a courtesan. So the attempt to correlate the three goals is awkward, and moksha is squeezed in alongside dharma and never mentioned again in this context. The Kama Sutra says, youth, childhood is the time to acquire knowledge and artha. The prime of youth is for kama, and old age is for dharma and moksha. So you're getting 4 into 3 there. Indeed, the only other time the Kama Sutra speaks of moksha at all is when it describes the courtesan's success in achieving the release, the moksha, of an unwanted lover, how you get rid of him. Surely a sacrilegious use of the word. And the Artha Shastra, too, never mentions moksha in a religious context, but only to designate the release, moksha, from marriage, namely divorce. The unusual use of this highly spiritual word to designate sexual matters in both texts is surely a bit of blasphemy that the Kama Sutra picks up from the Artha Shastra. It's also striking that the Kama Sutra gives pride of place not to its own subject, kama, but to artha, the subject of the Artha Shastra, a clear carryover from the parent text. And the Artha Shastra, Like the Artha Shastra, the Kama Sutra returns to the three goals at the very end of the book. The man who is well taught and expert in this text pays attention to dharma and artha. He does not indulge himself too much in passion, and so he succeeds when he plays the part of a lover. Again, Vatsyayana privileges both dharma, which he has relentlessly ignored throughout the book, and artha, the privileged subject of the text on which he's based his own texts. The Kama Sutra models both its format and its rhetoric closely on that of the Artha Shastra. The basic text is in prose, often followed at the end of the chapter by a few verses. More precisely, prose chapters containing down-to-earth, often non-dharmic or even anti-dharmic instructions are capped by verses in the simple shloka meter of the epics and Puranas that express often contradictory, generally dharmic exhortations. This hypocritical attitude to religion is one of the many unusual traits that the two texts have in common. I'll leave this to. Both texts begin with brief invocations followed by an acknowledgement of their debt to previous texts on their respective subjects. So the Artha Shastra states, this treatise has been composed for the most part by drawing together the treatise on artha composed by former teachers for gaining and administering the earth. Respect for the teachers. But in the final verse of the whole work, Kautilya is not quite so generous to his predecessors. Seeing the many sorts of mistakes in the writers of commentaries on the Shastras, Kautilya made the text and the commentary too. Vatsyayana too begins by invoking his academic ancestors, the scholars, the acharyas, in a long paragraph. But the word for scholars, acharyas, normally a term of great respect in ancient India, almost always have a pejorative tone in the Kama Sutra, perhaps best translated as pedants. And these scholars form what Hindu logic calls the opposing school, the Purva Paksha. So he says, scholars say this, but I say that, and that is the right thing. Both texts employ the technique of representing the possible arguments of opposing schools of scholars, setting them up as straw men and then demolishing them. But sometimes, on the other hand, both Kautilya and Vatsyayana will use the opposing schools, the Apurva Paksha, to say rather extreme things they really agree with but do not want to own as their own, to get them on the table and then say, oh no, don't do that, in much the manner that a lawyer might reveal evidence to a jury and then, when reprimanded by the judge, say, the jury will disregard these remarks. It's not always easy to tell apart these two agendas, setting up fall guys to demolish and using straw men to say what you yourself do not dare to say outright, since they both take the same outward form, ostensible disagreement. Kautilya uses this ambiguous technique, for instance, when he quotes the usual list of authorities as advocates of various measures for dealing with the king's newborn sons, starting from the suggestion that the king kill them at birth. Some people say, do that, he says. I don't do that. But he's mentioned it as a possibility. In the end, Kautilya objects to the more bloodthirsty suggestions. And then he caps the argument with his own more reasonable suggestion. If he's an only son who is dear to him, the king should imprison him. If he has many sons, the king should banish him to the frontier or to another region. But he's gotten on the table the more terrible options. The same sorts of arguments among authorities also occur in the Kama Sutra, which cites its standard list of acharyas, scholars, in a debate about whether or not women have orgasms as men do, presenting the cockamamie theories of audalaki and babravya, such as the fact that women have worms inside them that produce an itch that must be scratched, before stating and defending against objections by several unnamed interlocutors his own sensible opinion that women are like men in this regard. Elsewhere, Vatsyayana states, since learned men disagree, and there are discrepancies in what the Dharma texts say, one should act according to the custom of the region and one's own disposition and confidence. Note Vatsyayana's casual scorn for the texts of Dharma and his preference for individual conscience. Within this shared framework, there are also a number of incidental passages in which the Arthashastra has clearly provided the paradigm for the Kama Sutra. The Arthashastra advises the king to make use of actors dressed as gods of fire and water to demoralize the enemy during a siege. He says, when he desires to capture an enemy settlement, the seeker after conquests should embolden his own faction and terrify his enemy's faction by proclaiming his omniscience and his intimacy with gods. The proclamation of his intimacy with gods, however, is as follows. Conversing with and worshipping agents posing as gods of a fire sanctuary, agents who have entered the hollows of divine statues in the fire sanctuary through an underground tunnel, or conversing with and worshipping agents disguised as Nagas, serpent deities, and Varuna, the god of the water, emerging from water. The Kama Sutra prescribes similar play acting to a man laying siege, as it were, to a virgin. He should have a friend dress up not as a god, but as a fortune teller, and describe the man's fortune, good luck, future good luck, and prosperity to the girl's mother to earn her favor. And of course, the blasphemous nature of having your friends pretend to be gods need not be emphasized. Actually, I'm going to talk about that next week, the blasphemy in the Arthashastra. The use of black magic is strikingly similar in the two texts, both of which discuss it at length at the end of the text as a kind of afterthought or last resort, and both touch on magic in passing in other parts of the text as well. The Arthashastra permits a man to use love magic on a disaffected wife or a wife to use it on her husband, while the Kama Sutra does caution wives not to use it on adulterous husbands, but on the other hand devotes an entire book, Book 7, to the magic that a man can use on women, while the corresponding book of the Artashastra is devoted to magic used mostly for murder, not for love. Still, the magic techniques overlap in interesting ways. Both the Artashastra and the Kama Sutra offer magic spells to make you invisible, using an ointment that you put on your eyes, projecting sightlessness onto the person who looks at you. The Artashastra, like the Kama Sutra, is concerned that when you make yourself invisible, your shadow too must be invisible. And both texts offer formulas for magic to make you white, the purpose of which is unclear to me in both cases. If any of you could figure it out, I'd be glad to know. The paranoid psychology of the political text casts its shadow powerfully over the erotic text. Though the Artashastra is often said to be Machiavellian, Tautilya makes Machiavelli look like Mother Teresa. Suspicion, treachery, and trickery pervade the Artashastra, and some of this carries over into the Kama Sutra. The Artashastra list of people in the enemy's territory who are dissatisfied and can be seduced politically is the direct model for the Kama Sutra lists of women in other men's territory, as it were, who are dissatisfied or unsatisfied and so can be seduced sexually. Both texts often imagine the possible choices being considered in the mind of someone who might be plotting mischief. The internal debate of potential adulterers in the Kama Sutra, persuading themselves of the moral justice of their actions, mirrors the similarly imagined meditation of spies in the Artashastra, and the king's self-persuasions and justifications for seizing power. Another trait that the Kama Sutra picks up from the Artashastra is the constant use of male and female messengers, which makes little sense in the Kama Sutra, except as a replication of the far more meaningful constant employment of male and female spies in the Artashastra, the same word, dutta. Both texts, moreover, recommend the use of monks, nuns, and religious mendicants as spies in the Artashastra, or go-betweens in the Kama Sutra, in neither case demonstrating the least bit of respect for the possible actual religiosity or reputation of such people. Both texts pay close attention to people's involuntary gestures and revealing facial expressions as betrayals of hidden political or, as the case may be, sexual emotions. All of this spying casts a presumption of dishonesty and betrayal over erotic relationships, which remains a part of Hindu erotic discourse for centuries and centuries. The Artashastra uses spies to deal with problems posed by officials, noting the particular character flaws of each official that causes each problem. So, he should have the procedures overseen by spies, for an official may cause a loss of revenue through ignorance, if he's unacquainted with the procedures, through laziness, if he's incapable of enduring the travails, through carelessness, if he's addicted to sensual objects, through fear, if he's scared of agitations, or of acting against Dharma, through love, with regard to those who come to plead their cases, if he's inclined to favor them, and through anger, if he's inclined to hurt them, through arrogance, if he relies on his learning, wealth, or connection, and through greed, if he inserts discrepancies in weights, measures, accounts. The Kama Sutra cleverly adapts this template into a precise and rather cunning psychology of devising approaches for women who are differently resistant to adultery, tailing each approach to a particular source of resistance. If her resistance is connected with her nobility, he excites more passion. If it's a matter of apparent impossibility, he shows her ways to manage it. If the problem is her respect for him, he becomes very intimate with her. If it stems from her contempt, he demonstrates his extraordinary pride and his erudition. If it comes from his contempt, he prostrates himself before her. If she's afraid, he reassures her. In another pair of closely parallel texts, the Artashastra presents a fourfold typology of repentant traitors. Those who have left and returned are of four types. one who left and returned for a proper reason, and the opposite of this. One who left for a proper reason but returned without a proper reason, and the opposite of that. It is but the work of a moment for the Kama Sutra to turn this into a sixfold typology of lovers who leave the courtesan and then may or may not be taken back. If he's gone elsewhere, she must find out about him. He may belong in any of the six possible categories, according to the circumstances. He left her of his own accord, and he left the other woman, too, of his own accord. He left both her and the other woman because they got rid of him. He left her of his own accord, and he left the other woman because she got rid of him. He left her of his own accord and stayed with the other woman. He left her because she got rid of him, and he left the other woman of his own accord. He left her because she got rid of him, and he stayed with the other woman. The influence of the Ardha Shastra on the Kama Sutra is particularly visible in the techniques of testing. With the concern for particular individuals that we've noted as a property of effective spying, the Ardha Shastra suggests different ways to deal with young princes variously susceptible to hunting, gambling, liquor, and women, often called the four royal vices or the vices of lust. Quote, "The secret agent should guard the prince, saying, 'We are yours.' If he sets his mind on other people's wives out of youthful insolence, they should make him recoil by introducing him at night in deserted houses to squalid women posing as noble ladies. If he takes a fancy for liquor, they should make him recoil by administering a doctored drink. If he takes a fancy for gambling, they should make him recoil with the help of student agents who cheat. If he takes a fancy for hunting, they should frighten him through agents posing as bandits." Most specifically, however, the Ardha Shastra advises the king to test his potential ministers of four departments to make sure they are impervious to the temptations of each of the three goals, Dharma, Artha, and Kama. That is to say, they must resist Dharma, not they must follow Dharma. He also tells him to test the candidate against a fourth goal, not moksha, because remember, they never mention moksha in this context, but fear. So you have Dharma, Artha, Kama, and fear. Fear, which is often listed as the fourth emotion after the primary triad of desire, anger, and greed. So he's put something in place of moksha. The third test, which is the test of Kama in the Ardha Shastra, is this. A female wandering ascetic who has won the confidence of and is received with honor in the royal residence should instigate each high official individually, saying, "The chief queen is in love with you and has made arrangements to meet with you. He'll also receive lots of money. If he rebuffs it, he is a man of integrity." That is the secret test relating to Kama. Any man whose integrity has been proven through the secret text relating to Kama is to be made a guard of the harem. Those who survive the other texts are to be put in charge of the courts if they are resistant to Dharma, or the treasury if they resist Artha, or to become royal bodyguards if they are resistant to fear. The program then appears in the Kama Sutra as just a single test for the guards of the harem. But this one test combines the four elements, including fear, that the Ardha Shastra used to test four different sorts of ministers. Scholars, acharyas, like the wrong guys, right? Scholars say, guards stationed in the harem should be proved pure by the trial of Kama. Gonikaputra, one of the acharyas, says, but fear or Artha may make them let the woman use another man. Therefore, guards should be proved pure by the trials of Kama, fear, and Artha. But Vatsyayana, right, this is the right view, says, Dharma prevents treachery, but a man will abandon even Dharma because of fear. Therefore, guards should be proved pure by the trial of Dharma and fear. In the end, therefore, and in contradiction of Kautilya, whose opinion Vatsyayana cites under the disdainful rubric of scholars, Vatsyayana decides that imperviousness to Kama is not the most important quality for a harem guard. After all, fear and Dharma trump Kama. Kautilya, by contrast, states that the men who guard the harem need not be tested for kama, since they should be at least 80 years old, fatherly, or elderly celibate stewards. Patrick Olivel, who's just recently translated the Kama Sutra, says that translates that word as eunuchs, but I don't think they are eunuchs at this period. So, in any case, you don't have to worry about kama. On the other hand, Kautilya suggests that women of the harem must themselves be tested for honesty and dishonesty, lest they prove a danger to the king. For Kautilya is primarily concerned not so much to protect the king's wives as to protect the king from his wives, he says. Going to the inner chamber, he should meet with the queen after she has been inspected and cleared by elderly women. For Bhadrasena was killed by his brother hiding in the queen's chamber, and Kaudrasha by his son hiding under his mother's bed, and it goes on a long list of guys who were slaughtered in the harem. There's no direct parallel to this list in the Kama Sutra, which never warns men about dangers from women, but often warns them against the physical harm that they may cause women and of the danger from their own uncontrolled lust, which is a subject to which I'll return. But there's another closer parallel that appears in the context of this testing. The Arthashastra, speaking of testing the ministers, warns against the danger that one might corrupt the uncorrupted. Quote, like water with poison, for it may well be that a remedy may not be found for a person who has been corrupted. In other words, they flunk the test, but then they become bad. So too, when other scholars suggest that the young prince be tested by tempting him to attack his father and seize the kingdom, Kautilya objects, quote, to awaken one who is not awake is greatly detrimental, for a fresh object absorbs anything smeared on it. In like manner, a prince whose mind is fresh will accept anything he's told as if it were the teaching of a shastra, a treatise. Therefore, one should teach him what accords with dharma and artha, never anything that is contrary to dharma and artha. This same concern appears when the Kama Sutra speaks of testing the chastity of wives. Quote, the followers of Babravya, that's the Purvapaksha, that's the wrong guys. The followers of Babravya say, to find out about his own wives' purity or impurity, a man should test them through charming women who have deeply hidden their own involuntary signals and who will report what other people say. But Vatsyayana says, because corrupt people can succeed among young women, a man should not set in motion without a reason the corruption of a person who's not corrupt. And so the Kama Sutra suggests better ways to control women, primarily through knowledge of the Kama Sutra. One would have thought that the concern for the control of the senses would make far more sense in the Arthashastra context than in the Kama Sutra, but not so. An emphasis on the need for a man to control not or not just his women, but his own senses pervades both texts. The Arthashastra sees as more dangerous than any other threat the enemy within, more precisely the six enemies, desire, anger, and greed, the original triad of emotions, plus pride, conceit, and excitement. Spies in particular are advised to avoid women and liquor, to stay sober and sleep alone, for people reveal secrets through the indiscretions of love affairs. The Arthashastra's list of kings who were destroyed by treacherous women with mirrors speared with poison and lipstick with poison, all that kind of stuff, which has no direct parallel in the Kama Sutra, is matched by another Arthashastra list of kings who were destroyed by the far more dangerous enemies within. And the Kama Sutra uses an abbreviated version of the very same list of kings who are undone by their passions. But Vatsyayana in this passage is not speaking for himself. He is quoting people who worry too much about artha, artha chintakas. People we might call pragmatists, but in any case, people of other schools whom Vatsyayana imagines as objecting to his book about kama. So these artha chintakas, a negative term, are his Purvapaksha. He answers these objections by pointing out that despite its dangers, kama is as necessary to human beings as food is. But is Vachayana imagining such people, these people who object to the Kama Sutra? Is it not more likely that he's actually quoting the Artha Shastra and obliquely criticizing Kautilya for worrying too much about Artha? Certainly, Kautilya's definition of the shortcomings and disadvantages of Kama, pleasure, well, this is how he defines it, pleasure consists of disgrace, the depletion of resources and association with undesirable people, robbers, gamblers, hunters, singers, and musicians. That's his view of Kama. That view seems to be precisely what Vatsyayana is quoting when he quotes the people who worry too much about Artha as saying. So he objects to this. He says, they say, Kama makes a man associate with worthless people and undertake bad projects, impure, a man with no future, as well as careless, lightweight, untrustworthy, and unacceptable. So that's what he says the Artha people say about Kama, and it is in fact what Kautilya says about Kama. The inflicting of physical pain by scratching, biting, and slapping is an important part of the sexual act according to the Kama Sutra, and so is its aftermath. This is a poem that he puts in. A man who is marked with the signs of nails in various places generally disturbs a woman's mind no matter how firm it may be. There are no keener means of increasing passion than acts inflicted with tooth and nail. End quote. So the lover displays his or her scars as a warrior displays his scars. The Artha Shastra, by contrast, is concerned only about damage to women as property, primarily virgins, but also in passing, wives. It has no interest in protecting them from physical abuse or other kinds. Our final concern is the area in which the texts most explicitly converge, which is in the treatment of sexuality. For though the Kama Sutra has, as we've seen, absorbed a great many political attitudes from the Artha Shastra, it never discusses politics explicitly, while the Artha Shastra does explicitly address sexual issues at various points. On some points, the two texts agree, and on many, they disagree. In the Artha Shastra, sex is merely the background for political power, whereas in the Kama Sutra, political power is the background for sex. But the Kama Sutra's list of reasons that justify adultery include many that are far more political than erotic. This is some of what the would-be adulterer says to himself. He's a wonderful long passage of justification. This woman has her husband entirely under her control, and he is a great and powerful man who's intimate with my enemy. If she becomes intimate with me, out of her affection for me, she'll make him reverse his allegiance. Or, if I become intimate with this woman and kill her husband, I will get for myself the power of his great wealth, which ought to be mine. Or, this woman's husband is the seducer of the women of my harem. I will pay him back for that by seducing his wives too. Or, by the king's command, I will kill his enemy who is hiding inside. Or, my enemy is united with this woman's husband. Through her, I will get him to drink a potion. For these and similar reasons, Kautilya concludes, one may even seduce the wife of another man, but nothing rash should be done merely because of passion. That's the end of the adulterer's meditations. Thus, the Kama Sutra dismisses lust as an insufficient reason for adultery and regards using a woman to protect a king or kill an enemy as a sufficient reason for adultery. The basic distrust of passion is a quality that the Kama Sutra shares with the Artha Shastra, and the other rather far-fetched political motives are surely the direct legacy of Kautilya. The Artha Shastra regards as fair game a woman whom a man has rescued when she's been carried away by a flood or abandoned in the wilderness during a time of famine or left there for dead or rescued from robbers, from the current of a river, from a famine, from an upheaval in the region, or from a wild tract, or when she has been lost, abandoned, or left for dead. Similarly, the Kama Sutra suggests that a man might pick up a woman during the spectacle of a house on fire, the commotion after a robbery, or the invasion of a countryside by an army. All Kautilya's thinking about is getting women. When that happens, take your chance. Sometimes, rarely, the Artashastra is more sexually permissive than the Kama Sutra. The Artashastra takes for granted the woman with many husbands, who poses a problem even for the Kama Sutra. But almost always, the Artashastra toes the Dharma Shastra line on sexuality, where the Kama Sutra diverges wildly from it. The Artashastra insists that a man has to have sex with his wife during her fertile season. The Kama Sutra makes a point of separating sex from fertility. The Artashastra regards the deflowering of virgins to whom one is not married as a legal crime. The Kama Sutra regards it as a psychological opportunity to initiate a young girl into the pleasures of the bedroom. The Artashastra specifies punishments for a man who has sex with another man. But in place of the conventional law against sex between men, which the Artashastra accepts, the Kama Sutra first describes entirely non-judgmentally sex with an openly cross-dressing male with his stereotyped female gender behavior, and then goes on to discuss the fellatio technique of a closeted homosexual man in considerable sensual detail in the longest consecutive passage in the text describing any physical act, and with what might even be called gusto. The most significant divergence between the two texts on the subject of sexuality is their attitude to adultery, which the Artashastra regards as a legal crime. Quote, if she is not forgiven, the woman's ears and nose should be cut off, and her paramour should be put to death. And the Artashastra tells you how to smoke out the guilty couple. Quote, adultery is indicated by the caressing of each other's hair, or else by circumstantial evidence of carnal enjoyment through experts in these matters, or through the woman's confession. End quote. None of this is in the Kama Sutra, which devotes a whole book to minute and psychologically acute instructions to the man who wishes to commit adultery, and merely pulls back at the very end in those closing shlokas, which are always pro-dharmic, to warn the man not to do it and to guard his own wife. So, my conclusion. The Machiavellian base of the Kama Sutra's portrayal of the relationship between the sexes is expressed by its astounding statement, quote, they say that sex is a form of quarreling because the very essence of desire is a contest and its character is competitive. The commentator, Yoshodora, explains this contrariness because the man and the woman each try to achieve their own desires by overcoming the other. So they say, says the Kama Sutra. Who is the they in they say? Kautilya and his friends? In any case, this agonistic view of sex is the essential mythology of the Kama Sutra. What happens to gender issues when one applies to sex the Machiavellian politics of the Artashastra? The resulting agonistic and duplicitous view of sex set the stage for much of the mythological substructure of later Indian erotic drama, poetry, and narrative, as well as for the Orientalist mythology about Indian eroticism. As it combined with other factors in the Hindu social system that led to a more general devaluing of women, the Kautilyan Kama Sutra tradition contributed greatly to the culture of violence against women that has become so notorious lately in India. The idea that sexual desire is dangerous does not, of course, originate in our two texts. It's well documented in ancient India in the Mahabharata and Ramayana, centuries before the period in question, and it dominates the misogynist traditions of Hindu Dharma forever after. But the particular concept of a sexual relationship as a war with no Geneva conventions, a conflict in which the two parties tried to deceive and outmaneuver one another, an encounter that requires ambassadors and truces, a battle in which the combatants conceal or display the wounds they receive. These major themes of Indian erotic fiction owe as much to the Artashastra as to the Kama Sutra. In addition, both texts may draw upon a more general culture of violence and skepticism that thrived in India in that period outside the more idealistic world of the Dharma texts. And this more general tradition of skepticism is what I'm going to be talking about next Tuesday. In conclusion, the Kautilyan Kama Sutra was a major influence upon the erotic literary traditions of India, particularly but not only court poetry, which reveled in the suffering of the abandoned heroine, the tragedies caused by careless or lustful messengers, the deceptions and betrayals. But it played a less obvious but more important role in the eroticism of the bhakti tradition, with its emphasis on divine abandonment, deception, betrayal, and even violence. The surface metaphor of heterosexual human desire, with its clichés of nail marks betraying infidelity, leads to the dark implications of divine desire, the God who is not merely caught with lipstick on his collar, but who is not there for you as a God, the God who desires your pain, walking on fire, swinging from hooks, and who deceives you with his power of illusion, Maya. This, too, may be the legacy of the Kautilyan Kama Sutra. Thank you. So I left time for questions. I cut the
bits. Thank you, Professor Doniger. That was a really fascinating, interesting. It reminded me of the sort of the Dharma, the context sensitivity of Dharma that you've described. You use that phrase, either.
That's right. That's right.
And
in a way, the hypocrisy of the two texts. I always think of it in America for many years, the Hayes Office censored films. So you couldn't have a successful adultery or a successful robbery. So there's a long film in which there's absolutely successful adultery and or successful robbery. And at the very end, they're driving away and he looks away to kiss her and they hit a tree so they die. Or they drop the money when they leave the robbery or something like that. So that technically they're within the bounds. So I think of these bookends around these texts and the lip service to Dharma as situating themselves legally, but when you read the spirit in which the book is composed in both cases, it's severely anti-dharmic. And so I'm working on sort of the Charvaka tradition, sort of the suppressed skepticism in other texts in India as well. So that's so that begins with these old Dharma texts, old Shastras. Anyway, I said enough. You say something.
Questions or?
I wonder, could you just expand a little more on something very interesting which came very, very early in your lecture, actually, where you said that the Kama Sutra mentions the Arthashastra as mainly being about merchants and money.
That's right.
And yet, of course, you're then going on to show that the Kama Sutra
is political.
Is political and is influenced by the Arthashastra that we know.
That's right.
Can you expand on that a little? It's very strange.
When the Kama Sutra, I don't have it with me, I should bring it. I sort of know it by heart. When the Kama Sutra says that there are three goals and you have to take care of all of them, and you learn Dharma from good people and reading the Dharma text, it says you learn Artha from merchants and the text called the superintendent of the bureaus, really, which is one section of the Arthashastra, which is about taxes and all that kind of thing. So that's how bureaucracy, really. So that's how it says you learn Artha. You learn about merchants and things like that. And it says you learn Dharma from reading the Dharma text and from good people, and you learn Kama from men about town and from reading the Kama Sutra, right? So each one has a text. So the part of the Arthashastra it quotes is not the political part of the Arthashastra. And yet, it obviously knows the whole text. So it also defines Artha in a funny way, right? It says you learn, Artha is supposed to learn in childhood. Artha is getting knowledge and other forms of useful stuff which you get in childhood. So childhood is the period for Artha. Adulthood is the period for Kama, and old age is the time for Dharma and Moksha. So it's very weird. So that whole configuration is very strange. So I don't know why it says that, but it seems to me that it's evident that it knows the Arthashastra's politics as well. But you're right, there's a real conflict, and I should really say more about that.
Yes. Is there evidence from other sources of this view that the Arthashastra is about merchants and bureaucracy?
That's very interesting. I don't know. That's something worth finding out. certainly a lot of it is about money, and Artha in the Kama Sutra really means money. That's why courtesans need to know about Artha.
Yes.
Courtesans don't need to know about the king. Courtesans need about getting money.
Yes.
So it thinks of Artha as a financial subject in general, rather than a political subject in general. Yet the politics comes into this insane thing where I'm going to sleep with this woman because I can kill the king's enemies that way. It's just not why most people commit adultery, obviously, right? So it seems there's a lot of fiction going on here. There's a lot of myth-making going on here, including the fictional imagination of the political reasons for committing adultery. The list of reasons is very long. I picked out the political ones. There are some which are not passionate, but... another one is, I have no way of making any money because I'm no good at anything, but if I marry her, I'll get her money. I suppose that's also an Artha realization in terms of the concept. So, okay. Good question. There's a lot of good work being done on epic studies in a general way, but I do think that the mixture of erotic and martial imagery is just very old. There's some of it in the Rig Veda also, after all, really. And in fact, Alf Hilterbeitel's old good book on the Mahabharata, viewing the whole thing as a religious sacrifice. So these three levels, the Dharma, Artha, and Kama levels, are all there in martial imagery. It's a religious... war has its religious meanings, it has, obviously, its political meanings, and it is eroticized in a lot of texts. So I would say, yes, an awareness of the interaction of all of... That's why I said at the end... It doesn't start here. It's not like, you know, the Kama Sutra says, oh, the Artha Shastra says this. It's part of the culture, I think, which is brilliantly laid out in these two texts, so we can really see it vividly. But I think the connection between Dharma as well as Artha and Kama in the battle imagery is, in fact, a really valid layer. There is an eroticizing of violence in the epic. Certainly there is. Yes.
In your paper, there was you spoke about literary fictions just now, and, mm-hmm. and you're sort of teasing out attitudes and so on, which were otherwise hidden. So I just mm-hmm. it's a question: to what extent do you think that these texts reflect the social reality? On the one hand, they're mm-hmm. literary fiction, and yet on the mm-hmm. other hand, there's an implicit claim that they do actually reflect the social reality of the time.
The relation between fiction and reality, and also the thing I just sort of threw into the last paragraph about their role in religious reality as well. I think, for instance, the metaphor of adultery in the Bengal traditions that Ed Dimmock wrote about do not reflect, do not tell people to commit adultery. The Krishna Radha story, which is a story of an adulterous love, is not an argument for adultery. So obviously the imagery is not necessarily taken into social reality. The cross-dressing in many of the religious traditions is not connected with the Hijra tradition, which is a cross-dressing tradition of courtesans and prostitutes. I think that it's a fiction tradition, really straight through, and the tradition of literary fiction and secular fiction, the court poetry, feeds into what begins in South Indian bhakti, with a great deal of violence in the bhakti traditions, not just the Veera Shaivas, but the Tamil traditions, Kanapa ripping out his eyes and so forth. South Indian bhakti which is about love, and the love of God and God's love for you is very violent. So what I'm arguing here is that this conflation of the political text and the erotic text doesn't exactly begin, but let's say nourishes, because people read the Adi Shastra, they read the Kama Sutra, they used it a lot. It nourishes and perhaps justifies, makes it officially okay. It's officially okay to scratch and bite and slap, right? So we have a text that reifies a violent aspect of eroticism and that has it out so that people know about it. Then you get bhakti traditions which work on it in different ways. So it sets up, it supports, let's say, it inspires, it supports, it doesn't invent, but it continues and leads into and nourishes the violence of the bhakti traditions, which is not just physical violence, but the importance of viraha, which is an unhappy aspect of erotic love, which is the basis of a great deal of the bhakti tradition, where a great deal of your relationship with God is his absence. And so I think this is really quite important in terms of religious history as well as in the history of court poetry, where everybody bites and scratches and you see the scratches and so forth. It is the importance of absence. And it's also the importance of deception. I mean, the spying and the lying that goes on in the Adi Shastra has got to be, you've got to read it to believe it. And there's just a lot of spying and lying in the Kama Sutra too. It's not sort of true love where you speak your heart and he instinctively knows and all that kind of stuff. It's not that kind of love at all. It's how can I trick him into doing, how can I trick her? So there's a kind of maya in both politics. It's all just show, it's all just play acting, which again does not exactly invent the Maya traditions of Indian philosophy, but nurtures it and shows how it pervades human life in two very important aspects, namely politics and sex, that they too are not what they seem. And it supports the religious Maya tradition. So I think I end up going back to Manu after all. Yes?
Well, I just wanted to ask you to expand on something you said right at the beginning of the lecture, that this is about science and religion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
could
mm-hmm.
we just hire a new chair in science and religion? I would love to bring to him this South Asian or Indic interpretation.
Science
and religion.
Well, good, yes. Well, I've been... Let me go back in my own history. So years ago, I translated the Laws of Manu. And then Patrick Oliville brought out a different translation, which is useful in different ways. His notes are really much better, but I still like my translation better. And then I translated the Kama Sutra, which Richard Burton had very inaccurately translated years ago. And I've always, been, in my teachings of Hinduism, I've always taught the Purusharthas, the three Purusharthas, the triad. And I've always taught, therefore, the Adi Shastra as well. And I used the old Sharma translation, and I found with my undergraduates in particular, they simply stopped coming to class during the weeks in which I taught the Adi Shastra. They couldn't fight their way through the Sharma translation, which is accurate but unreadable. And then Patrick Oliville finally brought out a really very good new translation. So I started thinking more about the Adi Shastra, and I began to read it more carefully, and I read it against the Sanskrit because Patrick gave me the notes when he was working on it, and I was teaching it and seeing how the Sanskrit worked, and I noticed these resemblances. So I had it in my mind to do something about that. And then I was invited to give the Terry Lectures on Yale, which are lectures in science and religion. Don Lopez wrote the last one, which was Science and Buddhism, or Buddhism and Science, and so forth. So I started thinking about what I knew about science, and I realized that the Shastras are the scientific tradition of India. They are the Elephant Book and the Horse Book and so forth, and that Dharma is in some way it's one aspect of the religious tradition of India. There's a lot of things as well, but you could certainly translate Dharma as religion. And therefore, the way that the scientific texts treat Dharma is a very interesting example of the relationship between science and religion in ancient India. and more generally the skepticism of the Shastric tradition and the way it interacts with Dharma. I want to argue, I think, in this book that the skeptic tradition is very deeply ingrained in Indian texts, and that the people called the Charvakas, who are always quoted as the bad guys, those are the Purvapakshas, that these wicked Charvakas say that their Brahmins are no better than anybody else and there's no heaven and there's no point in doing sacrifice, all this noisy stuff. And of course, we don't have their texts. There's one Charvaka text, quite late, the Jayarashi text, but everything else, I think, is people really using the Charvakas as an excuse to say what they think, or what they would like to think, or what they might think. You know, there are people who say that there's no such thing as heaven. There are people who say that sacrifice is... I don't think so. Oh, I certainly don't think so. But there are these people who think so. So I was getting more and more interested in the way that the Purvapaksha functions in all texts, to say something that sometimes the author actually does believe. In the Kama Sutra, for instance, Vatsyayana really has a fairly, constrained attitude toward what sexuality is like. So he describes a lot of things he doesn't like. He's writing the encyclopedia. He has to put it in. So they're more violent. He says, some people do this. Now, you really shouldn't do this. Some people do this. You really shouldn't do this. So he uses other people doing certain things to get on the table what he really regards as part of sexuality that he disapproves of. So there are different ways in which people imagine other views. And I think that the Dharma texts, that the non-Dharma Shastras, the Ardha Shastra and the Kama Sutra in particular, and one could look at the Ashva Shastra, which is a wonderful text I've used elsewhere, that the scientific texts pretend to support Dharma, but in many ways undercut it with skeptical views of the reality of the world. And I want to trace that trace. For instance, this passage we'll look at next Tuesday in the Ramayana, where Jabali comes and says all sorts of things which are anti-Dharmic, and no explanation is really given for why that's there. People say, well, don't listen to him. He's just saying it to test you, Rama. He doesn't really believe it. Well, why is it there then? Why is there this long passage about how Brahmins are stupid, they're just out for your money? I mean, he goes on and on and on saying very naughty things. But don't listen to him, he's just testing you. And Rama says, that doesn't make any sense to me. Rama's a good guy, he doesn't believe it. So I want to find these places where this other voice of skepticism is aired throughout the text. I'm beginning with the two texts I know best. And I want to kind of trace it through. So that's my take on science and religion. Science both as the Shastra tradition and science also as skepticism and a more rational tradition. The argument that Charvakas always said to make, you should not do the Pinda ceremonies for the ancestors, the Shraddha, which is the most important Hindu ceremony, where you feed the ancestors. If you don't feed them, they suffer. You've got to feed them, the Pindas. So they say, you know, if that works, then no one would ever have to take food on a journey. The people at home would simply eat for them, and they could travel, right? So this is a really flat-footed, hard-headed attitude to rituals which involve food. And everybody quotes that. It's in the Ramayana, you know, quoted wrongly and so forth. So it must have been a thing that people said. This is stupid. Why are we doing this Shraddha, you know? But you couldn't say that. So the Charvakas say it and so forth. So that's what I'm. That's where I'm trying to get at with this book I'm working on. I began with these two texts because I just know them well. So this is chapter one. Yes, Faisal.
Thank you very much for that talk. Wonderful as always. I was thinking about the afterlife of the Ardha Shastra in particular, because I've been interested as someone who works in modern India in the category of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, the Ardha Shastra is rediscovered in the 1920s at some point,
mm-hmm.
and it creates
quite
a huge sensation. But what I find so interesting is that modern Indian important political thinkers, 19th and 20th century, don't seem to take into consideration. They opt almost uniformly for the Gita, and therefore they make politics entirely dharmic. And yet, it's only in the use of the English word politics that the Ardha Shastric as it were, skeptical tradition,
mm-hmm.
the non-dharmic tradition mm-hmm. seems to come through. So when you use the English word, even
politics,
today, mm-hmm. politics, it's immoral and Machiavellian and all the rest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas otherwise, it's all about the Gita. And when you were talking, mm-hmm. It struck me that in these ancient texts, Kyoto Richard was saying about why is it the merchants, for instance, are mm-hmm. foregrounded, or the connections between the Kama Sutra and the
mm-hmm.
Shastra.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible, I wonder, to say or to suggest that one of the things that might be happening here is a kind of speculation on the nature of the categories themselves,
mm-hmm.
on Kama and
mm-hmm.
on Artha.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm particularly interested in what the political might be. And
mm-hmm.
from what you tell us, there's mm-hmm. it's not simply twinning and matching. That it's almost as if there's an ontological evacuation.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, is there such a thing? It goes back to what you're saying about skepticism.
Mm-hmm. Is there
what
such
might actually be
politics indeed?
If it's the same thing as what courtesans do and what merchants do.
Mm. It's interesting. Very interesting. There's the word niti, too.
Yes, of course.
And there's the niti shastras besides
yeah.
the dharma shastras. And then you get things like the Panchatantra, which is also about the education of princes, which is also what we would call a Machiavellian text, where sneak and lie and cheat and so forth like that. So there are... The English word politics doesn't... You know, I gave you three words just in the beginning, just to start the lecture, what you could call artha. And there's even more words you could get for dharma. And actually, kama is more common. People always think it's about sex, but it's about pleasure. It's about desire. Pleasure and desire and sex are very different things, and they're all there. In English, they're very different things, but they're all there in kama. So the artha in the artha shastra is a lot more than politics. And also, it does not cover all of politics, because niti shastra is a little different from artha shastra.
That's what survives in modern as Rajniti.
That's right, Rajniti,
politics, yeah.
which is not exactly a synonym at all. So you have several different political traditions. You have the beast fables, which have a lot of what we would call politics in them. There's a king, the lion king and the jackal and all of that. Then you also get the politics of both epics. We're talking about epics, that both the Mahabharata and the Ramayana have enormous amount to say about politics, and very different. So on the one hand, in the Ramayana, you get the squeaky clean politics of Rama and his family, and the dirty politics of the wives, and the dirty politics of the monkeys. So you have this pure image in the middle, but you have a great deal of realism going on in the whole of the harem politics and the blackmail and the monkeys each accusing the other one and so forth. In the Mahabharata, you get long discussions, some of which quote the Artha Shastra and do not quote anything we have in Kautilya. Basically, do anything you can to win. I once knew very well an ex-Marine who was trained in the American Marines. One of the first things they taught them in unarmed combat was always kick a man when he's down. That's the sensible thing to do. Let me give your hand, take me up like in the cowboy movies. Let me pick you up and now we'll start fighting. No way. You kick him when he's down. So the Mahabharata is always kick a man. So that too is part of the Indian niti tradition. So politics is... not a word which really fits nicely into this, really. For one thing, you have the realm of the king, which is what the Artha Shastra is about, but you also have the realm of the merchant, which is what the Kama Sutra seems to say it thinks the Artha is about. And then Artha, of course, means so many things. It means success. It means a goal. It kind of more broadly means getting what you want in any context, including sexual and cuisine. I don't know. It could mean... So politics really doesn't really summarize what that tradition is about. It's also pragmatism. It's the pragmatist tradition, in a way. How can you get something done? And the answer is abandon morals, is the ancient Indian answer to that. If you want to be a moral person, that's very nice, but you won't get what you want that way. So I see that as... So you say he had political reasons for doing that, right? Meaning not what he says. It, in that sense, it does translate into politics.
But there's a way of homogenizing them, I think, simply. Mm-hmm. Karma, short-term. Artha, mm-hmm. longer-term.
And dharma, really.
They tell you in the end.
And that's right, that's right. The Kama Sutra defines concern for dharma as concern for something which is invisible. Anything you do for the sake of something you can't really see, that's dharma, right? If it's visible, then it's not. So it's very... skeptical, really, about dharma in many ways. Yeah. Yes, a hand in the back.
I mean, just kind of building on that point. What you're describing is an ancient Indian, what Faisal just mentioned was, you know, we're talking about, like, realism, right? So I study international relations.
Any text that tells you how to make yourself invisible, I say is not a realistic text.
But it also deals with politics. It deals with politics, making money, government, creating a spy base. Mm-hmm.
You think that's more realistic than getting into bed with some woman?
Hold on. So okay. I was going to say, though, that, you know, I mean, like, we look at books on the CIA now. You just told us your story about the Marine killing someone when he's down. I mean, doesn't it also describe kind of like the realities of the world? And is it so funny you keep laughing at it? I mean, I just mean, like, I know it's a political... when I hear it, and I think Dr. Shastri, I see this political text, and I guess you see it as a magic text with other things. But I mean, like, I could see that, too. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, we could see this both, yes? Or how do you see it? I guess I'm trying to...
It's a realistic text to the extent that it deals with a lot of real things. The part of the Arthashastra I did not talk about today is the weights and measures and how you levy tolls going off bridges and whether a cow with two spots is worth more than a cow with one spot. I mean, it's enormously detailed in a lot of things about the nitty-gritty of life. So it certainly covers a great deal of material life. It certainly is a very material book. I guess I think it's also realistic because I think the world is a rough place and you do have to abandon morals to get what you want a lot of the time. I think that's the way the world is. It's a cynical view of the world. So I think those parts of it are realistic. The fact that it embraces magic simply it means that they consider realistic things that I don't, but the attitude is the same, really. Same way you can use penicillin, so they use the eye of Newt and the head of a snake that was hung up three times and so forth, and it maybe worked as well as penicillin. So yes, in that sense, I think it is a book about real life, and it has a cynical and, in that sense, realism, what we call realism, right? You see a realistic film, it means it's not romantic.
So I meant like in a natural sense.
Yes. So I think in that sense it really is a very realistic text, and it reflects what governments do, which is dishonest. The idea of the Dharma Raj is a great Indian ideal, and it comes up all the time. And there are beautiful descriptions of Rama's kingdom where no one ever gets sick, and, you know, it just never happened. There never was a Dharma Raj. But it's a lovely ideal.
And on that note of a lovely idea, perhaps we should bring this evening's lecture to an end. Thank you so much, Professor Doniger, for a wonderful lecture. And it's so exciting to be at the beginning of a kind of new project which will come to fruition in the book in the future.
I hope so.
And,
thank you.
Yeah, so till next time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.